More infighting between the mayor and the city council over the possible sale of JEA. The Kids Hope Alliance hires a familiar face as its first CEO. And racial strife hits the local Democratic Party. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we're always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, we're spending most of the hour this Friday with our media roundtable, backed by popular demand. And you can get on the line right now at 549-2937. Then later, the premier women's leadership event for this area, Generation W, is 1 week from today. We'll hear from one of the major speakers. That's ahead. But first, it's Friday and time for our weekly roundtable as we welcome four all-stars to discuss the biggest stories of the week. David Bauerlein is here from the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
Claire Goforth, editor at Folio Weekly, joins us once again.
Good morning.
John Burr, our own WJCT analyst.
Hi, Melissa.
And our own producer and reporter here at the station, the unimpeachable Kevin Merchart.
Good morning.
Good to have you all here with us. Lots to talk about this week, everything from a controversial pick for the new Kids Hope Alliance CEO to a turkey rating for plans to tear down those Hart Bridge ramps. We'll tell you about that, too. And strife within the local Democratic Party over race. All of those stories ahead. But our top story this morning, the feud is getting even more heated at City Hall over the potential sale of JEA. Mayor Lenny Curry penned a letter Tuesday accusing City Council President Anna Brochet of seeking the spotlight. Curry also aired some other grievances he has about a special council committee that's been exploring the pros and cons of privatizing the city-owned electric and water utility. Curry has been battling allegations that he has privately pushed for a sale of JEA behind the scenes, despite publicly saying he has no opinion about this proposal. The latest on this right now on the roundtable, and 549-2937, that's 549-2937, or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, and you can also weigh in on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. David Bauerlein, let's begin with you. Curry, in his letter to Brochet, says, "At this point, the pretense of a desire for good faith communication with me is completely exposed. I will treat all missives from you as part of a public relations effort rather than an attempt to accomplish the important work we are obligated to do for the people of our city." The love affair between these two only grows. What about this?
I think Anna Brochet has 3 months left in her term, though, as president. So she is the council president for another 3 months. And so, like it or not, that is who is running the show at city council in terms of how the JEA process moves forward. It sounds like after all the back and forth, there was some grudging agreement towards the end of the week that the administration will work with the committee to provide information. So there's a lot of pyrotechnics going on, but you know, ultimately, this special committee is the only show in town in terms of exploring JEA.
And it's been difficult to get information. Not only that, Claire Goforth, I think the mayor has been hit in terms of batting away allegations that he's trying to engineer this behind the scenes and instead of publicly making the case for why this might be a good idea, what the city could do with the money, if in fact that is what he wants to accomplish.
Certainly, and the mayor refuses to take a position on the sale of JEA, which, full disclosure, my husband is a JEA employee. The mayor's office this week is also, they haven't really said anything about that radio spot that we've all heard with the child's voice saying that Lenny Curry wants to sell JEA that's paid for by the PAC, I believe it is, that opposes the sale. But the mayor, in this latest back and forth with Council President Brochet, his office is starting to seem a bit unhinged. There's an undercurrent of anger and just dramatics. It's like as City Hall turns right now going on. And I mean, what else, what is getting lost in the conversation about what other things, what other priorities the city has? There's a lot going on that we're not talking about because it's really just a one pony show right now. And that's the JEA sale.
549-2937. John Burr, Kevin Merchart, as Claire pointed out, the soap opera aspect of this is sort of obscuring the important information, which is this a good idea? What are the benefits? What are the negatives? Let's have that discussion right here.
Well, that would be nice, but we're I'm afraid we're about 2.5 or 3 months and a lot of animosity past the even the possibility.
And do you think it's gotten so acrimonious that that's not even worthwhile now for the public to do that?
Oh, it would always be worthwhile. I mean, but it's not possible, not with this cast of characters. And, you know, Aaron Bowman's going to be the next council president. I have no idea how he feels about JEA or the process or anything else, but that could be a restart for the whole thing, or it could be a continuation. We'll see.
Kevin.
It is interesting that, we had Matt Schellenberg on, this week, who has long been a supporter,
another city councilman, yeah,
councilman, and he was pushing this long before anyone else even thought about it, and his opinion was, well, at least we can talk, and that's not a problem, and well, what is this thing worth? That's probably worth a conversation of, well, let's find out what is somebody willing to pay to purchase this entity, because we really don't know. No one has a clue. I mean, we have some. We've seen some numbers come out, but the it's so much a huge diversion. I mean, from $1 billion to $6 billion. Well, okay, $6 billion maybe is worth talking about. $1 billion, even Schellenberg says, no. If it's a number that low, I'm not even going to waste our time doing that.
Yeah, he said if it's $4 to $5 billion right. The city could net from this sale, then he, in his view, that it would be worth it to privatize. David.
Yeah.
And the real next question is, not do you want to sell JEA, it's do you want to put JEA up for sale? Mm-hmm. And that's not a small step to take, mm-hmm. because once you do that, that means you're not just doing it as an academic exercise. You're spending a lot of money mm-hmm. to prepare the process, and you're basically saying, yeah, if we get a good offer, we're selling. So there's a lot of debate back and forth now whether you even want to take that next step.
That's right.
And the reality is, it's a huge, huge step. And in Jacksonville, things of that nature don't happen unless there's a big, strong push by the chief executive, which is the mayor. And so there's a lot of suspicion that, well, why is it that things are kind of moving that way if there's not
why not wave the flag for this publicly if that is the intention?
5 months into this process and so much has happened and there hasn't been a vote on it. I mean, we're just basically barreling forward toward this, what still looks like almost an inevitable conclusion mm-hmm. without any actual weigh-in from the city council or the JEA board that's an actual vote on
you
this
issue.
You mean
by inevitable conclusion, you mean a sale?
I mean, it seems like it. Why are we this
and
far into the process?
Are the votes there for a
sale?
That's
right. True. Sale or no sale. A story in the Times Union today, I think, did you write this, David? I think on Plant Vogtle in Georgia. I think that might be actually the deciding factor here. There's a huge nuclear project up in Georgia that the JEA is committed to keep pumping money into. The thing has got cost overruns in the billions, and that could shave the city's profit out of a sale JEA by up to $1.7 billion, which would make, if that's true, that would really make the case for a sale.
It would or would not.
It would make it much weaker.
A weaker case. And of course, the public pushback to this, Kevin, that the city council members are hearing is from ratepayers. They don't like change. They're worried about their rates going up.
And a lot of people are worried just like local control of the utility, because your power goes out, then you can call somebody. And it's different than, well, who is it that's in charge if we sell this? Is this Florida Power and Light or somebody else? Is the service going to be the same? I mean, we've talked about this many times here on this show. I think we've got maybe two calls from people who said, okay, maybe it's an idea to look at this. Mostly what we're getting phone calls from people is saying that, no, don't do this. Either I'm convinced that my rates are going to go up, or I don't want to lose local control of my public utility. So that is a big step that those who support this are going to have to make through, because as we've heard from lots of members of the city council, and you need 2/3 of a vote from the city council, is that they are getting bombarded by people saying, don't sell JEA.
Claire.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. And all of the conversations I've had with people about this online, in person, reader mail, I can name maybe one person who has had any inclination to sell JEA. I mean, JEA sits on top of one of the most plentiful water resources in the world. And we talk about the electric generation side a lot because that's seen as the most profitable, but actually the water could be the most profitable, especially as the world's water resources are being depleted. Years down the road, we could all be paying an astronomical figure for the water, particularly if it is sold to a for-profit entity. Not to mention which, if a for-profit entity now wants to sell all of our water to cattle or to any other interest that they want to citrus, then they would be able to. And those are some very real questions that we need to ask ourselves. Then we have the fact that how many millions of dollars do you think Jacksonville would kick into a private company to bring 2,000 high-paying jobs to Jacksonville, which is what JEA provides?
Oh, well, a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. And what Claire's saying about the water is really fascinating, because JEA is water and electric. It's all intertwined. And it's been interesting to find out that really the water side of the operation is perhaps the most coveted side of the operation.
That, I don't think people realize that, did they? Yeah.
They don't. But yeah. You know, there are a lot of people here who were customers of for-profit companies that were bought out by JEA within the past generation. And they are not going to be happy if they found out that they were going to go back into ownership by a for-profit company
for their water. Yeah.
Okay, absolutely. And it's lots of calls this Friday. It's our Friday media roundtable as we discuss all the top stories of the week. We want your calls now at 549-2937. Carrick at the beaches. Carrick, hello.
Hi. I just want to say I have a lot of respect for Amber Shea and Jared Dennis for their candor in informing the public, keeping the public informed. Whereas with Mayor Curry, the public perception for me isn't really looking too great, because he continually refuses to take a stance on the issue. And just from that perspective, it sort of hurts any movement forward. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for that. You know, the mayor did admirable work in terms of deciding pension reform was an important fiscal issue for the city. He sold that to the public. He sold that to the state legislature. But in hindsight, would that making that public case, building consensus, bringing all stakeholders in, would that maybe have been a better approach to this, if this is, in fact, a big priority for the mayor's office?
That would usually be the way that these kind of things are done, through sort of that community consensus, as opposed to it kind of coming out of left field with something where a board member gets it started and then moves it forward in that way. So you're right. I mean, ultimately, if JEA were to be sold, that's the kind of conversation, that's the kind of political will that would be needed. And you need a political mandate, because there is no political mandate. Nobody on city council or in city hall, with the exception of Matt Schellenberg, ever ran a campaign saying, if you elect me, I will support selling JEA.
Certainly the public perception is that the mayor's office supports this, and that the whole subject was brought up at the behest of the mayor's office. But, you know, the problem is if you are pro-sale JEA, nobody's making the case. There's a complete vacuum on that side of the question. And everybody you hear, including everybody from the public and everybody who's talking to other council people, are against it. So we're not hearing any pro side.
Ron and Mandarin, go ahead, Ron.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for bringing this subject up again. First of all, I'd like to point out that this JEA is a public utility. It's owned by us, the citizens of this town. And if the young lady said that this has been under discussion for 5 months, we're just hearing about it actively only in the past short time. That's number two. Number three is, if JEA is set up for profit, that profit should not go to support other departments in the city. That profit should go into research and development. We've got a whole river out here that there's a lot of industry talk about using tide currents to generate electricity.
Okay. Thanks, Ron.
Yeah, he makes a good point. The public feels probably left out of the conversation. Nobody consulted them before we got to this point in the process. And I would like to, I think John Burr made some excellent points, but there is actually one entity that has come out pretty strongly in favor of selling JEA, and that has been, sorry, David, the Times Union Editorial Board. They have written numerous editorials talking about the tasty cake that we're going to get out of that money. And I mean, you know, you look at what Jacksonville has historically done when it gets lots of money, is it hands it off to all the big cronies who do the city contracts. And again, this is, we end up back in the same position where we overpay for a courthouse. And
Martina emails the show, ask your guest, John Burr, to estimate how much money would be paid in commissions and fees to mergers and acquisitions type people who would handle the JEA transaction.
Well, sure. The investment bankers are salivating over the prospects of making huge fees, tens of millions of dollars on this. But, you know, that is part of the process. But before they get involved, you have to agree to go down that trail, as David said, and that's a big decision.
Right. And as like Mark Woods put in his column, or go back to the Better Jacksonville plan. People weren't crazy about that at the beginning, but John Delaney went out all over town and said, this is what we're going to do. This is why this is an important thing. And it easily passed because he took charge of this. And no one seems to be taking charge of why should we sell this. There are some arguments that you could use to say, maybe this is the time, because currently, JEA, you're never going to get a better deal now than now. This is probably the best time. So if you're going to sell it, now's the time to do it. 5 years down the road, you're not going to get the kind of dollars you're going to get from now. But still, who's out there saying we should do this? I mean, very few voices are out there saying this is a good idea because they're not selling it to the public. All we hear from people from the public is this: why should we do this?
And why should
we lose local control of our utility?
Let's take a few more calls on that, and then we'll move on. By the way, they had a big retirement party last night for UNF president, former mayor John Delaney. They're naming a building on campus, the Delaney Building. So that was a nice thing for him. Joe in Arlington. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Good morning. One of your panelists touched on what may be the core issue here. And that is that this represents a potential hijacking of the Florida aquifer for private purposes. This is a public water supply, and here we are talking about selling control of a significant portion of it to private industry. And I think it should be opposed on that basis alone.
Okay, thanks, Joe. David in Mandarin. What do you think, David?
Hey, I think we're missing the big conversation. The conversation should be is how in 2008 we took on the obligations of a nuclear plant ownership and did not tell the public. If that can happen, what else can happen? And things haven't changed. Everything is hidden here. Nothing is really explained to the bottom and driven from the bottom. They can buy a nuclear plant in 2008. They can do anything. That would have been way controversial, so they just hit it and did it. Same processes are there. It needs to be discussed and say, how can you invest in a nuclear plant without telling us? So they just consider us the children. They don't need to talk, get an agreement, or do anything.
Okay, thanks, David. Yeah, I take your point. David Bauerlein, you wrote about the JEA nuclear woes in today's Times Union.
Actually, Nate Monroe, my colleague. That's a huge albatross. I would disagree with the caller. There was obviously votes taken in public meetings. This was not something that was hidden from the public, but it was not something at the time that people expected would create this huge ticking time bomb in terms of what it would, the blowback would be down the road. And it's a huge issue. I still don't understand exactly how big an issue it is. You know, obviously, if you want to know what the value of JEA is, you sell, you say, what do you want to buy JEA, but take it lock, stock, and barrel, take on Plant Vogel.
Yeah.
Then you know, but there maybe there's moves to try and carve it out and try and get it shifted out of the deal, which would be worrisome in terms of who does take on that obligation that's left with us.
Michael in Riverside. Go ahead, Michael.
Hey, guys. Thanks for the conversation. Just a quick observation and a question. I'm a Jacksonville native since 1966, and it is not until the last couple of weeks that I started seeing FPL commercials on TV. And my question is there any link here? Are we re-seeing like that movie Wag the Dog, you know, where we're conditioning the minds of the people with some media advertising just to prep for what is the end game intention? You know, why is FPL all of a sudden got really high-tech, sexy commercials on TV that we've never seen before?
Well, you just referenced one of my favorite movies, Michael, so props to you.
It's a great one, yeah.
I haven't seen anyone throwing shoes up on utility lines like they did in the movie for their
You don't live in my neighborhood.
Okay, but what about his comment?
But he's right. They have been running commercials in Duval for some time. I think it's actually been several months. I remember one during the Super Bowl. Usually they only do ad buys during hurricanes in our market. And so this is a departure from that. It's also worthy to note that in the presentation of PFM's financial analysis, whatever you want to call it, there was an FPL representative at City Hall that day.
Okay, well, clearly this is the hot topic of the week once again. But we are going to move on now here on the Friday Roundtable and discuss some other important stories from the week. Keep listening and calling the number to join us, 549-2937. And in another controversial process, we want to talk about this too. A divided board yesterday selected one of their former colleagues to be the first permanent CEO of Jacksonville's new child welfare agency, the Kids Hope Alliance. Joe Peppers, an operations manager at the Amazon Fulfillment Center here in town, was chosen to lead the agency in a 4-2 vote. This despite strong opposition from some board members who cited his lack of experience. Jim Clark, the CEO of Daniel Memorial in Jacksonville for some 20 years, one of the premier child welfare nonprofits in town, was came in second as choice for CEO on this. Peppers applied for the job, and he had his first interview while still a sitting board member. This was called a conflict of interest, so he resigned. A candidate for the job from out of state actually pulled herself out of consideration, saying she felt the process was not legitimate or that perhaps a fix was in. For his part, though, Peppers has issued a public statement upon his appointment, saying he disputes perceptions that he is a crony or a figurehead in the mayor's pocket. 549-2937, as we discuss the new leadership of the Kids Hope Alliance. John Burr, your thoughts.
Well, to me, this sounds like a classic fight between, do you want a guy with experience or do you want a guy with passion? And I say guy, girl, whatever. And so it's a passion versus an experience fight from my perspective. And the guy with the passion won out. Is that the right choice? Time will tell.
David.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of reservation from some board members about hiring somebody for this position who does not have day-to-day experience in this type of work. And
this is a guy who is making sure packages get delivered at the Amazon Center.
Did you get to interview him? Didn't he go to Amazon? I read the paper this morning.
I did not know he was not there.
I want to be clear. They chose the guy who's running packages in and out of Amazon over the guy who ran Daniel Kids for 20 years.
Right. And I think it goes to John's point, which is an argument could be made that somebody can come in and learn on the job, but has a sort of passion, the commitment to really excel at it. So that's the calculation, I think, that was made by this board in terms of who they chose for that position.
Okay, and what about his statement disputing that the process was set up in such a way so that he could be critics on this process said, a figurehead doing the bidding of City Hall rather than an independent CEO with his own ideas.
It was interesting that he felt the need to clarify that point. I don't know him. I don't know his life story. I'm told that it's very compelling. But, you know, I'm comfortable with my friends. I'm comfortable with the people who I know professionally. But does that mean that they're qualified to have this very high profile, very important position that makes a real difference in children's lives, children in our city who need help the most? I don't think so. I mean, you know, I'm sure that the other candidates have plenty of passion for children because they've dedicated their careers to it. So I don't know that alone, because someone is very compelling in an interview, probably because they're comfortable with me because we're friends, does that qualify them for this position?
Yeah, this is not unlike everything we just heard in JEA. Probably could have been handled a lot better by the board at the Kids Hope Alliance, because it just appears that there's something here that it doesn't match. I goes, why is he the best candidate? Have you come out and told us why you think he is the best candidate? Why is he better than Jim Clark, who has been here for 20 years and everyone connected to this city knows, and that this is a guy who has been spent 20 years of his life helping at-risk kids. He's helping orphaned at-risk kids for 20 years. So why is this guy who's been where he has a record. He's had a lot of things, but none of this associated with helping children. He was in the military for a long time. So yes, he has some leadership qualities, but it's the appearance here. Why is someone not taking charge and saying, this is why this is the guy we think should be running this place?
I think they did. They voted 4-2 for him.
Yeah. But they haven't made the explanation of why it is that he should be held, particularly since he was on the board. That was probably the big thing. He should have resigned from the board long before he applied for this job.
Yes. And here's a tweet from yesterday from Mayor Curry's chief of staff, Brian Hughes. Dedicated servant, Army vet, West Point grad. A good man unfairly put through a nasty process by a bully. Thank you, Joe Peppers, at JoePep23, for standing tall. Jax will be better for it. And by bully, I'm guessing he's referring to maybe City Councilman Garrett Dennis, who really spoke out publicly against this whole thing.
That's what I thought, too. And Garrett did make his position very clear that he thought that the board should not hire Joe Peppers. I don't know if that's bullying. That's basically just...
Isn't that his job?
Something about pots and kettles comes to mind.
All right. Well, we're gonna talk about some other items from the week. This one was a very hot item from the week. Oh my goodness! I heard so much about this. A racial rift in the local Democratic Party leadership. DNC member and Florida State Democratic Committee man John Parker stepped down from his post this week after admitting to using racially insensitive language. Parker admitted that he used the term colored people rather than people of color when he was referring to African Americans and Jacksonville's history of integration and school integration in particular during a lunch in January with other members of the Democratic Party. After much outrage, hue, and cry, complaints, he resigned his post. Now, this was an awkward situation for Parker's wife, Lisa King, who just happens to be the Duval County Democratic Executive Committee chair. She issued a statement about this. And observers of this whole process have been quick to point out that this local flap is certainly reflective of a larger issue within the Democratic Party as a whole, in terms of tensions between two constituencies, African Americans and white progressives, and in some cases, Southern whites who have been Democrats for decades and come from a more of the Dixiecrat, I guess you might want to call it, Democratic tradition. And we saw this tension play out right here in Jacksonville this week with this whole imbroglio. Claire Goforth.
Yeah, I think that it was probably a miscalculation on Mr. Parker's account, a part to not resign previously because it had to get so far to the, he had to reach the point where his own wife basically called on him to resign, which is, you know, I mean, you hate to see some dramatics like this spill over into a marriage, but this is exactly what, you know, the Democratic Party has been struggling with for years. As you said, Melissa, there's the disconnect between the white progressive side and people of color, you know, so if the Democratic Party has a hope to take back in the 2018 midterms and to take back some seats in Jacksonville, it really needs to get it together on these issues.
Right. I mean, the Democratic Party in Florida has a lot bigger problems than this. And to drum somebody out with 35 years experience over was admittedly a slip of the tongue and not a malicious remark. Everybody admits that.
Not everyone. But the problem is not everyone saw it that way, according to what I've read about this.
Well, but the person who did the investigation admitted that.
Okay.
Not admitted, right. But said, yeah, he was not malicious at all in this. Still, we feel the proper step was him for the leave.
Right. State Senator Audrey Gibson, right. Representative Tracy Davis, both called upon this man to step down.
Right, and Gibson referred to generational differences. Well, I'm 54 years old and months away from, you know, a senior discount, and I've never used the phrase "but colored people" ever in my life to describe African Americans.
Right.
Maybe it's because I grew up in Michigan, maybe it's different in Florida, but does that come out of your mouth? How does that come out of your mouth in a Democratic, knowing where you are and who you're surrounded by?
And I've got to be perfectly honest. I haven't used that term, but I didn't know that it was it really polarizing.
Not sure that it was, yeah.
And honestly, to be complete, I'm sorry if that reflects poorly on me, but I was unaware that it was that.
No, it doesn't reflect poorly. You know, but now colored people, we know that colored people now joins the N-word is a word you can't say without getting in trouble. So
David,
forewarned is forearmed.
I'm like the others. I had no idea that it was such a... that it was something that you should not say, or at least I did not know that it would have those kind of repercussions of saying it. And there's a distinction between saying people of color versus colored people. You know, a few years ago, not to really go into this, but in great detail, but we had somebody who lost a job with the Duval Public Schools because she recounted, talked to her about her husband as being
a redneck. Yeah,
and
I remember that.
Again, something that maybe a blind spot. I would never have thought that would have resulted in somebody losing a job in that case or being forced to resign from a party committee post in this case.
I guess it's indicative of how poor communication is and how much mm-hmm. of a racial divide there still is between groups of people in this city and in this country that, you know, white folks really could not, literally didn't understand that this is not a good thing to say, and this will offend a lot of folks. Let's go to Linda in Bay Meadows. Hi, Linda.
Hey, I just wanted to give a little pushback with John Burr, you know, saying, you know, the guy was being pushed out of the party and because of a slip of the tongue. I find that normally people are pretty careful in public, so if that's the slip of the tongue in public, then I have no idea what's going on in private. Yes. I'm hoping if he was a Democrat for over 30 years, for the good of the party, he would have stepped down before it made it to national news on Politico and on New York Times. You know, that's what he should have thought about the party after he made his quote-unquote slip of the tongue. But I think it's kind of people of color, colored people. That's not cool. I don't think it's a slip of the tongue. I think it might be language that's used in private that slipped out in public. So I think he should have just resigned before it blew up into the national footprint for the Democrats, because of course, and Jacksonville doesn't need this kind of information out there about us anyway. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for that. Thanks, Linda.
Yeah, and I think maybe it wasn't just the term, but I believe based on what AG Gankarski wrote in his column in Folio Weekly this week, that some people who were there, their perception was that he was insulting desegregation, you know, that he was saying that that was the thrust of the comments.
And that just shows you how differently people perceive things, because other people perceive that he was saying, no, I was talking about when schools were integrated, that was the time frame in Jacksonville when things got intense. Or, you know, I won't use this.
Yeah, I mean, not everybody heard it the same
way. Not everyone heard it the same way.
And it was at a dinner. I don't know I would characterize it as public, although, I mean, you're out with people that you know. I mean, it's not as if it was on a public forum. It was a dinner among people who maybe he felt were friends or colleagues, a little bit closer relationship.
I always think of, there's this GOP pollster named Frank Luntz who's been really effective on behalf of Republican candidates, and he always counsels people when in his work, it's not what you say, it's what people hear. This is a classic case of that.
Well, it is. And now I think from this stand forward, everybody knows that this is something that you should not say. I think it's an evolving situation, obviously. And there may become a year where we'll have a discussion and somebody will have used the term people of color, and that will be viewed as insensitive. And, you know, there'll be a changing norms in terms of that. And somebody said, well, I didn't realize that was offensive. Well, it is offensive. And so, now you know, and you have to step down from your committee post.
Yeah.
Yes. Meanwhile, the Republicans are laughing.
Okay. Okay. It's certainly true. Not good for the one party to be divided when the other party is seeking to unify, obviously. Let's go and talk about something else quickly. It's this whole thing about taking down the ramps of the Hart Bridge. Florida Tax Watch listed the $12.5 million the state has set aside to help Jacksonville demolish those ramps between the Hart Bridge and downtown as a budget turkey. The watchdog group annually lists state budget items it believes are not needed or didn't get enough vetting. Tax Watch says the project didn't go through the normal process as it should have. So let us know, callers, do you think those ramps on the Hart Bridge should come down? Give us a call at 549-2937. Kevin Merchart, TaxWalk says, labeling it a turkey isn't a judgment on whether it's a good idea or not, just that it wasn't reviewed properly.
Right. And this is another one of those examples of an item that's the mayor has strongly supported, but why do we need to do this? Really hasn't been told to us that much. I mean, it's been there. If you're going to sit there and say Shad Khan wants to buy the shipyards, he doesn't want his condos overlooking this giant bridge, then say that. Just point it out.
I think they have said that, though.
They've sort of, but not in as many words. They just sat there and said, we take this out. We think this will help development in that area. But as regular taxpayers or people who drive on this every day, they're going, I drive on this as opposed to getting stuck on Gator Boulevard?
And the mayor has said for public safety, to modernize public roads, and now to improve truck access to Jacksport's Talleyrand Terminal. David Bauerlein, those are the official reasons why they want to do this. And also, as Kevin pointed out, Jaguars owner Shad Khan wants to beef up waterfront development all around the football stadium, radically transform it. These ramps get in the way of that.
Well, to Kevin's point, the pitch that this is to help freight move truck traffic from the Hart Bridge to the Talleyrand.
That exit is going to still be there.
A Talleyrand connector. It's a ramp that comes right off the Hart Bridge and drops you right off near the Talleyrand Boulevard. So this idea that this is all being done because we want to get freight traffic to the port, that's not the reason this is being done. It's done because there's a major economic development project for downtown that would be, according to the Jaguars.
So in other words, all three of our top stories today come back to this theme of how transparent is the process. Is that what I'm hearing you say? Because it's not what you say, it's what people hear.
It's public.
That's really what you're saying, isn't it?
It's marketing and public relations versus reality, you know, and it's pretty much the same players that we're talking about here.
Because nobody going, no truck going to Jacksport Talleyrand is going to be riding on that giant overpass there, because they're not going downtown. They get off the same exit that station.
You don't say. I do want to point out that In Duval County, there are 21 structurally deficient bridges and 86 functionally obsolete bridges. Right. So maybe that would be better use of those millions of dollars.
You think?
Okay, well, let me play devil's advocate and say, okay, let's say they get the money for this. Sure. Those ramps come down. Khan gets his whole wish list. He radically transforms the waterfront. Bars, shops, restaurants, condos, you name it. The USS Adams docked on the North Bank, the Navy freighter that they want to make into a museum. Is it worth now that investment if downtown gets all of those goodies, which seems to be the goal here?
Does Shad Khan need money? I didn't know that he was destitute.
Well, to answer your question, yes. But but people are saying, just say that. You know, give Shad the land. Tear down the damn ramps. Let him build his wonder village, and just be honest about it. Okay.
Right. Yeah. Right. And there are lots of cities that have done just that. They've said, you know, there was a time where we all built freeways in the downtown, and now make it more pedestrian
passe,
friendly.
Yeah.
There's an argument to be made there for sure.
Henry emails the show. I love the speed of those ramps getting into town. Leave them alone. All right. Thanks for that, Henry. Mark is on the line in Orlando. Hi, Mark. Good morning. How's the thaw things down your way?
Well, it's not Jacksonville.
That's true.
On the subject of traffic.
You got that right, sir.
Yeah. Two quick things. The brouhaha, losing your job because the words people of color is okay, but colored people is bad. I mean, that's right out of 1984. You know, the guy speaking in a public forum, you know, we all get a little tongue-tied, and he loses his job, and he's posed as a racist? Really? And second of all, yeah, I agree. Let's just call it Shad Khan's project and get on with it. He's going to get the money one way or the other. You know, why confuse the issue? You know, we always bent over for these NFL owners going back to Bud Irsay, so why should this be any different?
Tell us how you really feel, Mark. Really? Okay, thanks for the call, Mark. Thanks for the call.
The point is, nobody has a better idea what to do with that land than Shad Khan, and nobody has the ability to do it like Shad Khan, and he's gotten the cities okay to do it. So let's go ahead and do it. I mean, you know, move on. That's the thing about Jacksonville. We always throw up all this dust, and about 10 years later, nothing's been done.
Right, and the history of the shipyards is that if you have someone here who you know actually has the financial dollars to actually do something with the shipyards after we've had so many years of we're all going to do this, and also other downtown projects where we've had such grandeur and press conferences and groundbreakings that led to absolutely nothing. If he says, okay, this is what we're going to do, and we're all waiting the state of the franchise speech coming up in just a couple of weeks, we're probably going to learn more about what's going on.
Yeah, we'll watch
but
that.
He's Shad Khan is a business guy who we're going to do this. Let's get it set and then do it. But make sure he has everything in plans. He's not one of those people who says, "Hey, maybe we should do this." His answer is, "Okay, get it down, get
and
it set,
do it.
And do
okay.
it."
Okay. And finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from all over the state this week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now. Only in Florida does a school superintendent get pulled over for failing to stop for a school bus. Superintendent Desmond Blackburn of Brevard County got issued a warning during School Bus Safety Week.
Oh, my goodness.
He admitted to the infraction and thanked police for their focus on keeping kids safe. And only in Florida do savvy storm watchers dread the return of the Weather Channel's Jim Cantore to their particular beachside location. Yes.
Never a good thing.
It's almost that time again. That is not the guy you ever want to see outside your window.
If you see him, get out.
Get going. Researchers say conditions are ripe for an above average number of hurricanes this year. They're predicting 14 named storms, 7 hurricanes, and 3 major hurricanes. Strap in, everybody.
17 of which will hit Florida.
I hope not. Gosh, after last year, let's hope not.
But don't say global warming.
We'll be right back. Thanks for listening, everyone. Quick break.
Nova Southeastern University, NSU, offers a variety of graduate programs with flexible schedules throughout Florida and here in Jacksonville, and has more than 50 undergraduate programs to choose from. More information available at nova.edu.
Santa Fe College and Visit Gainesville present the 49th Annual Spring Arts Festival in historic downtown Gainesville, Saturday, April 7th and Sunday, the 8th. Fine arts, crafts, food, and activities for the entire family. Details at sfspringarts.org.
In 1923, the wealthiest people per capita in the world were the Osage Indian tribe in Oklahoma, thanks to oil deposits on their land. On the next Fresh Air, David Grand talks about the serial murders that followed as local whites targeted the Osage for their money. He's the author of the best-selling book, Killers of the Flower Moon. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
I'm John Dankosky. Dogs do it, birds don't. Whales and even cockroaches do, but goldfish don't. I'm talking, of course, about passing gas, breaking wind, or farting. On Science Friday, we'll talk to some experts in flatology, the study of flatulence, and what makes turtles toot and gorillas gassy, but why octopuses are methane-free. We'll talk about it on Science Friday from PRI.
Friday at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Syria, should we stay or should we go?
I want to get out. I want to bring our troops back home. I want to start rebuilding our nation.
Mixed messages on the Middle East, more tariffs as China retaliates, and in Brazil, a former president loses his long battle to avoid jail. The global edition of the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, it is the premier women's leadership conference in our area, and Generation W is coming up 1 week from today. Yes, we've got a preview with the founder, Donna Orender, here in studio. Hey, Donna.
Good morning, Melissa.
And joining us by phone, Shelley Diamond, Chief Client Officer for Young and Rubicam. Hi, Shelley.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. And it's great to have you on the show here with Donna. You'll be leading a discussion on social impact at Gen W next week. What are you going to be talking about?
Well, you know, it's probably a watershed time in our country, maybe in our world, where people are taking a hard look at how they can make a difference in the world. They're not counting on just NGOs and corporate social responsibility to do it. They feel that they want to take on some of the important responsibility of making this world a better place. So in that regard, we're going to be speaking with a panel of pretty remarkable people. Donna and actually, I believe it was Sophie Mickelson came up, a 16-year-old, with this notion, and we certainly see it in the marketing communication world, that it just takes one person to do one thing to make one positive change in the world. You know, you look at what's happening and it's daunting. And then you can be inspired by people like Mark Bustos, who cuts people who are homeless, who cuts their hair and makes them feel better about themselves. Or Stacy Smith, who's the CEO of Sweet Natural Holistics, who is teaching people how to eat healthy and eat better. And a 16-year-old, and we've seen it with in your own state with the young people who have taken on the issues of gun control, the power of sort of taking a position and doing something to make one person's life better. And the fourth person on my panel will be a woman named Catherine Thomas, who is using yoga to help inmates and
Yoga
vets.
For Change. Yeah, the local group Yoga for Change. Yeah.
So
Donna Orender, this sounds like a really exciting lineup.
Well, yeah. You know, the whole idea is people come, and especially us as women, we look at other women and we say, I can't do that. That's, you know, I'm sitting here with you, Melissa. I can't do that. Melissa's so amazing. She's on this pedestal.
Well, I couldn't have run the WNBA and you did that, so.
But the idea is, this whole idea of, one, the focus on kindness today. We can all be kind. We can all do one thing. And this is all really coming after this tremendous talk by Lani Ali, Muhammad Ali's widow. And I actually say, I looked at the materials. But first thing I got up this morning, I had some new material on my desk and honestly moved my heart and my soul. And to take a day honestly, to be moved in ways that get you to reevaluate where you are, what you're doing, to realign your efforts, is a day we all owe ourselves. And you know what, from a corporate perspective, right? To have employees who are so engaged in life in a way that's so positive. And I think that's what's happening. When, you know, listen, Shelley Diamond, you know, she's a global leader at one of our leading global agencies, YNR, to take the time, I flew up to New York to spend time to talk about this. The fact that she is leading this effort globally for YNR, and she's gonna come to Jacksonville to do this is incredible.
I think that speaks to the caliber of speaker that you've attracted over the years to Generation W. It is a week from today here in town at the UNF, on the UNF campus. Shelley Diamond, this will be such an exciting day for everyone that gets to come out and hear you speak, and also a really full day lineup of great speakers.
Oh, my goodness. You know, I must say, one of the things, and I can say this sincerely, and I know Donna lives, this is how Donna lives her life, you get so much joy and pleasure and gratification by sharing your passion with others. I think you get more from them than they do from you. So I hope they come and just know that this is about rallying the troops, making everyone feel after one day that, yeah, there's one thing in this world I can do, one thing I've learned, and one person whose life I'm going to touch. And if you multiply that by the thousands of women that will be there and the people they touch in their lives, it's an old commercial for Herbal Essence. And
I don't remember that one, Jill.
So on and so on. I believe that.
I know, absolutely. Hey, Shelley, and one thing we want to do, actually, you know, this is one day that we talk about that lasts a year, and it does. We are also taking an effort. We're launching. We want to launch. We have our last panel of the day. The day totally builds to a great crescendo at the end. From hashtag me too, to hashtag time's up, we're ready to launch our own hashtag right here in Thought Leadershipville, Jacksonville, Florida. This is we have people from 25 states join us, but it's going to be hashtag our time. And we're going to be asking everyone to think along with us. How do we make this our time? We're tired of talking. We want to do. And I think that this conversation with Pat Garrity, Deb Goldfarb, who's coming from L.A., hashtag our time. Let's think about this. Thanks, Melissa.
It's our time. It's Generation W time. Next Friday, April 13th on the UNF campus. Get your tickets now. GenWNow.com. Donna Orender, always great to see you.
Thank you, Shelley Diamond.
On the line. She's chief client officer for the global firm Young & Rubicam. She'll be speaking next Friday. Thanks, Shelley.
Thank you for having us, and we hope everyone joins us. We will have an amazing day.
It's going to be a great day. Everyone needs to come out to it. And thanks for listening. That's our show. If you missed anything this morning, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock and keep listening all through the day. We'll be back at 1 o'clock this afternoon for our statewide look at the biggest stories of the week on the Florida Roundup. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCTFM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. See you then. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.